Chapter 70. The Institute for Intelligence and Special Operations, known as the Mossad, a Hebrew word for institute, has its principal office in a fortified campus, a block and a half from the sea in North Tel Aviv. In a second-floor conference room, mid-morning sunlight beamed across a long, polished table where a laptop played a recorded conversation.
Nizar is quick to call names, but here I agree with him. I'm in the middle of production. I can stop. But 300 more victims. 300 more wailing, mortified families begging Israel to concede the land and stop the occupation? That has great value.
2,300 dead enemies will certainly be regarded as the most glorious jihadist victory since the Twin Towers, and right in the heart of our enemy. Do not fear the discovery of my lab. I have wired it for destruction. If necessary, I can instantly firebomb the building and obliterate all remnants of our operation.
It appears that Kayla has been right all along, Harry said to the group as the recording played on.
And 5ER is the date? Yom Ha'atzmaut?
Harry nodded. Makes sense, doesn't it? The rest of the group grunted their approval.
What have we overheard since then?
Nothing. Bakery noises. Apparently there have been no further meetings at the Breadstone Bakery. That was the last recording of the group.
So, what stops us from going into this maniacal doctor's factory and grabbing what he's got?
Remarked Eliezer, an older man in an open collar, white shirt, curls of gray hair poking out from beneath his woven kippah.
You heard the tape. He'll blow the building if there's an assault. Besides, 2,000 devices have already been delivered to an unspecified warehouse in Jerusalem. They're not at the factory anymore.
All the more reason to strike immediately. Let him blow the building and all the terrorists with it. Who gives a shit?
And where are the 2,000 bags? And what's in them? Harry said.
Kayla feels that if she can enter the compound and distract the doctor, allowing us to quickly gain access to the outbuilding, we'll find out the details of the plot. The nature of the devices, when and where the attack will occur. She thinks a precipitous strike would prompt the group to destroy the factory and all evidence of the operation, or worse, move up the attack.
This group, these are the so-called Sons of Canaan?
Eliezer said.
Right.
We should not wait, said a woman in an IDF colonel's uniform. We should go on tonight. The devices may be in a warehouse, but it's possible the logistics are not yet in place. We gain an advantage in scrambling their plan.
Around the table were grunts of approval and nodding heads.
Good point, Yonit.
Harry interrupted.
Getting Kayla inside is our best chance of learning what we need to know to stop the attack. She and Summers are due in a few hours. Why don't we give her the benefit of the doubt? We owe her that courtesy. It's her op.
A few hours won't make any difference. The entire operation is scripted. Give her an audience.
Agreed,
Eliezer said.
That's only fair. We'll reconvene at 3 p.m. and listen to her.
Dmitri looked at the caller ID on his cell phone and uttered a Russian expletive.
Hello, Victor. What is it you want this time?
Don't brush me off, Dmitri. I'm the one taking the heat here. I've been served with another fucking subpoena. Apparently, when I walked out the last time, Lockhart got a court order for me to come back and finish my testimony. I have to go back tomorrow at 2 p.m.
So go back. Testify.
She knows, damn it.
I don't know how she knows, but I can feel it. Maybe Darius talked to her.
She knows nothing. You're a gambler. You go to basketball games. Big deal. You go to her office. You shut your mouth. You tell her you don't know anything.
And if she asks about Panama, you shut your mouth, Dmitri screamed. Are you hard of hearing? You don't know anything. Repeat after me. I don't know. I'm nervous. Can't you do something?
Yeah. I can do something, all right. Goodbye.
Kelson stared at the phone in a shaking hand. He didn't like that last comment.
I thought you said that Sophie and I were going to Amman this week, Labana said.
I changed my mind, answered Al-Zahani. I need her here.
Need Sophie? Need her for what, Arif? It's my concern. Arif, talk to me. Why do you need Sophie here?
Al-Zahani started to walk away, thought better of it, and returned to Lubana.
Summers is coming here.
Tears formed and streamed down Lubana's cheeks.
He's coming to take her.
Al-Zahani shook his head.
He will never take her from us. She will never go back to America, do you understand me? She will never leave Palestine.
Then why? Why, Arif? Why is he coming? Why are you letting him come here to our home? Let me take Sophie to Amman.
Arif gently put his hands on Lubana's shoulders and smiled.
You know, you have been a good wife to me, and I haven't always been patient with you. For that, I am sorry. He is coming because he thinks he is going to leave with Sophie, but I will not let that happen. And you must let me handle this my way.
Handle what, Arif? What is there to handle? Why does he think he can take our Sophie? You told me that would never happen.
He is bringing money. He is so foolish that he thinks we will accept money to part with Sophie.
Then we will lock him out, she said firmly. Bashir will not let him in the gates.
Arif shook his head but smiled kindly at her.
No. I must tell him myself. I will let him see Sophie. You will walk her into the room and then out. He will see her and then he will leave. It will be good closure for Sophie.
Arif, have you lost your mind? If Sophie sees him, she'll be hysterical. She won't leave the room.
You must let me do this my way. I will ask to step out of the room just for a moment, and when she returns, Summers will be gone. She will be told that he left without her, and we will be done with her pining. We will never hear from him again.
Lubana's face grew serious, and her lips taut.
I see through your plan. Do not take me for a child, Arif. You intend to take his money.
And stop, do not conjure up diabolical scenarios. It is simply as I have stated. We will do it my way, and there will be no further discussions.
With that, Al-Zahani left the room. Kelson's chauffeur entered the dining room where Kelson was eating a late dinner. His hat was in his hand, and he stood sheepishly in his black wool coat.
I'm sorry, Mr. Kelson, but I thought you would like to know.
Know what?
Evgeny. I saw him drive by the house. I thought he was coming to pay you a visit, but he kept right on driving. I waved, but he did not wave back.
Impossible. Evgeny is in Europe.
No, sir. He's here in Chicago. I saw him quite plainly.
Kelson's face rapidly lost its color. He stammered.
Who was with them?
No, by himself. He was alone. He slowed down and then drove on.
Kelson stood quickly.
I need my coat.
Where are we going, sir?
He shook his head.
I won't need you tonight. Give me the keys to my wife's car. I have something to do myself.
Kelson took his coat from his chauffeur, walked into his den, and closed the door. In a side cabinet, a key ring hung on a nail. He fished for a brass skeleton key and used it to unlock a desk drawer. Inside lay three handguns. He chose the Walther PPQ M2 and a 9mm magazine. He shoved the gun into his belt, locked the drawer, replaced the keys, and walked to the garage. Chapter 71. Catherine paid the taxi driver who carried her heavy luggage up the stoop to her front door. She was tired after her 10-hour journey from Hawaii. She fumbled with her key, finally getting it into the lock. Suddenly, she felt a strong poke in her back and a voice said, "Don't say a fucking word, just open your door." She turned the lock, opened the door, and was pushed forward into her foyer. The door slammed behind her and she turned to see Victor Kelson pointing a black handgun in her face.
"How did you know?"
he said.
"Know what? Don't fuck with me!"
he screamed.
"How did you know?"
"I'm not going to talk to anyone who holds a gun in my face." Kelson waved the gun in the direction of the living room.
"Move.
He directed her to sit on the couch, and he sat opposite her on a wingback chair.
Now talk. Tell me how you know about me and Dimitri.
Why does it matter? Kelson nervously waved the gun around.
It matters to me, he shouted. We had it all worked out.
Catherine bit her bottom lip.
Son of a bitch. It was both of you. The two of you arranged for the kidnapping and stole the money. Committing multiple murders and embezzling millions. That's what you call having it all worked out? It was perfect. Perfect until you figured it out.
How did you know?
Perfect. She shook her head. I have to tell you before you do anything crazy tonight. There are others who know what I know. The FBI knows. Killing me won't help. It won't go away. It will only make it worse for you.
It was Darius, wasn't it?
He told you.
It doesn't matter how I found out.
It's over for you.
I know that. Kelson lowered the gun and his voice. I didn't come here to kill you.
I may be a lot of things, but I'm not a killer. I want you to give me a deal.
I'm listening.
I know everything. I know where the money is. I can be a witness against everyone involved. Dimitri, Yevgeny, Gregor, Yuri, all of them. I want witness protection, and I want a deal. You know who to call. My lawyer's an idiot.
They're after you, aren't they? You're the loose end. You're the next target.
He nodded.
He didn't say it, but I heard it in Dimitri's voice tonight. Yevgeny's returned to town. There can be no other reason.
Is the money still in Panama?
He shook his head.
Caymans.
Catherine sat silently for a moment, then pointed her finger.
The gun.
Kelson slipped the magazine out and slid the gun across the table. Catherine took her cell phone out of her purse, searched for a number, and dialed.
Hello?
A whispered voice answered.
Tom, it's Catherine Lockhart. Sorry to wake you. I guess I have a habit of calling you in the middle of the night.
Tell me that you don't have another Nazi SS guard, the assistant U.S. attorney said. She smiled.
I have Victor Kelson sitting in my house. He has information about the embezzlement and the murders that he'd like to share with you. He wants to talk a deal, and he needs protection.
I'll send a car over.
She hung up the phone.
You didn't need the money, Mr. Kelson. Why did you do it?
Well, everyone needs money. But it's about leverage. Taxes on $88 million would take almost half of my money away. If it's stolen and no one knows I have it, there's no taxes. I split the stolen money with Dimitri. I get $44 million tax-free. And I still have my lawsuit against Jenkins for another $88 million. Simple math. I'm $44 million ahead.
And that was worth the lives of several men?
I never knew he'd kill anyone. That wasn't the plan.
Ellis and Harrington were each supposed to get $1 million.
Summers, well, Dimitri was running a number on him.
Whose idea was it to kidnap Summers' daughter?
Totally Dimitri's. Brilliant, I must say. We knew Summers was essential to the plan. We also knew he was too honest to take a payoff, so Dimitri said, everyone's got a soft spot somewhere. I'll find his. And they did. He flew the grandparents and the daughter to Palestine and then told Summers he could ransom her back. Fucking brilliant. Would have worked, too, if it wasn't for you.
Catherine shook her head.
It would not have worked.
It was Darius, wasn't it? All I did for that kid, that son of a bitch.
You didn't give a damn about him or his career. All those years he and his mother sacrificed to get him to the top. You tantalized him with chump change and tried to ruin him.
You think he's so innocent? He and his friends were the ones who came to me. I've been a Deacon's booster for years. They found out I paid for points in the past, and they wanted to cash in. Darius and Marcus came to me after a preseason dinner and told me they could keep the next game within the spread. They wanted $500 apiece.
Kelson shrugged.
Easy money.
Headlights illuminated the living room, and there was a knock on the door. Catherine let the two agents in. On his way out, Kelson said, "It would have worked."
"You're an asshole," she said.
Chapter 72. Fakir brushed his hands on his apron and finished counting his money. It had been a lucrative day at the bakery. He was bushed. He ambled back to his sitting room and plopped down hard on his couch. He heard a sound, as though something small had dropped to the floor. He thought it was a coin. For the moment, he thought, let it be. But then a coin is a coin. He looked under the couch and on the floor beneath saw a small black plastic square. He picked it up. It had no markings. Then it came to him.
"The fucking IDF!" he said aloud.
He called Faiz and demanded an immediate meeting of the group. Al-Zahani received a text message calling for an emergency meeting at Faiz's house. As his gates opened and his Mercedes pulled out onto the street, a young man on a bicycle took a cell phone out of his pocket and made a call. A light blue Ford picked up Al-Zahani's trail 2 blocks later. Numerous photos of the members of the Sons of Canaan entering Faiz's residence were taken and simultaneously emailed to Mossad headquarters.
"Why have you called us all here to your home, Faiz?" said Ahmed when the group had assembled.
"I let Fakir explain."
With a shaking hand, Fakir held up a plastic bag for all to see. It was filled with the remains of the small listening device he had smashed with a hammer.
"You all laughed at me when I said the IDF knew about us, that they knew about the meetings in the bakery. Now you see, you are all fools. I was right."
"It is indeed a listening device," Rami concurred. "It's safe to assume that the IDF or the Shin Bet now know of our plans."
"What do they know?"
Nizar said sharply.
"That we meet? That we hate Israel and wish its demise? Does that make us unique?"
Faiz held up his index finger.
"We've only met at the bakery once in the past few weeks. If the device was there for our last meeting, they know what we discussed. It was a very short session, as I recall. What did we say?"
Nizar responded,
"We said we have 2,000 bags, that they're in a warehouse in Jerusalem. I don't recall our being specific. Arif talked about his laboratory, that he can produce 40 bags a day."
"Did we say what was in the bags?"
Al-Zahani shook his head.
"That information was discussed at the apartment. We only said that we should forego the extra 300 bags, that there would be 300 victims."
"And we said it was set for April 16th,
Fakir added.
"That's true. We revealed the date."
"So what?"
Faiz said.
"They lack the essential details to defeat the plan."
"I agree with Faiz,"
Al-Zahani said.
"If they knew the details, if they knew who the participants were, they would have picked us up by now. They would have already stormed my compound. They would have seized the Jerusalem warehouse. Have they done any of that?" "No. The bags are still safely stored. Sami is still making his daily runs. We are still here."
"Nevertheless, we should postpone our mission," Rami said.
"They are alerted to the date. They will take extra precautions on the 16th.
"Reluctantly, I must agree,"
Faiz said quietly.
"We'll have to reschedule after the summer."
Nizar stood defiantly.
"Well, I do not agree. Where will they take extra precautions, Rami? Do they know of the hospitals? Today, they know nothing. Next month, they may learn more.
Every day presents an opportunity for them to investigate, to spy, to overhear. For one of us to make a mistake. I say we act immediately. Tomorrow. Why wait? We are poised to strike and they are not ready."
Faiz stroked his beard.
"Is this something we can do? Can we put it together that quickly?"
The members looked at one another and nodded their agreement.
"Why not?"
"Then call Sami. We move tomorrow, the 10th.
Fakir held up his hand.
"Faiz, when the attack occurs, what becomes of all of us? One by one, we will be captured and jailed. Or worse. They know who we are. They have surely seen us come and go from my bakery."
Faiz folded his hands and leaned back.
Myself, I will stay here. You may all do what you think is best. You will find safe harbors in our neighboring countries, if that is what you wish.
I will never leave Canaan, Al-Zahani said. It is in my blood. But why would any of you have to leave? I assure you, they will never prove a connection between us and the deaths that will take place in Jerusalem. I have told you again and again. This is a foolproof plan. The bacteria spread undetected throughout the system for days. One by one, the victims will start to fall sick. Maybe after a while, they will enter a hospital. 2,000 will die a horrible death. Then we will post a message online claiming responsibility, but not from the Sons of Canaan. From some random Gaza group. We will tell them that the deaths were caused by freedom fighters, but nobody will be able to tie them to our group. They are looking for us to act on the 16th, not the 10th. In fact, I predict we will repeat this very operation in Tel Aviv and Haifa later this summer.
Rami shook his head.
No, my friend. When so many die, the IDF will investigate. They'll find out the poison came from the IV bags. I doubt we'll ever be able to repeat. But we will have had a successful mission. I'm with Arif and Nizar. We go now.
Fayez nodded.
I agree. They are preparing for the 16th. The doctor's wisdom is hard to refute. Tell me, Arif, how are your plans coming along for the ransom? When is the forlorn father expected to bring his suitcase full of money?
In a couple of days.
Do you need our assistance? Do you need help in disposing of the body?
I have more than enough manpower to deal with this lawyer and his companions.
He has companions?
He hired a private investigator who negotiates for him. It is the private investigator who proposed the exchange and confirmed the details through Abu Hamad. You will accompany him along with a nurse.
He needs a nurse.
Al-Zahani shrugged.
He is in a wheelchair. He was in an accident and cannot walk.
Fayez shook his head.
This is beset with too many coincidences. Too much intrigue.
What intrigue? I will bring them into my house and secure the money. Then my men will take them out and get rid of them.
Why do you need to bring them into your house? Why don't we just grab the suitcase and shoot them all as soon as we see them?
Nizar asked.
He's not that stupid. He says the briefcase is rigged to explode unless the correct combination is entered. Whether true or not, there is no harm in letting Summers open the case. He will do it in my house because he has demanded to see the child.
This is an IDF plot, Fakir said nervously. Another IDF plot.
To do what, you fool?
Nizar said.
To get into Arif's house and sniff out our plans. Maybe to get the child?
If they wanted the child, they'd take the child,
Al-Zahani said.
She goes to school every day. They could take her on the sidewalk. If they wanted to get into my house, they'd force their way in. I can't stop the IDF. But they won't, because the Israeli government is too concerned about overstepping its bounds and creating a crisis in Hebron. No. This is just a desperate father, working alone, trying to retrieve his daughter. And he's willing to pay a small fortune. Nothing more.
What if the father shows up with soldiers to arrest you? What becomes of you then, Arif?
What becomes of me?
I have done nothing illegal.
The child was placed in my custody by the father's agent and flown to Amman. He has not contacted me since. I will simply return the child to her father, who has come to fetch her. And unfortunately, my laboratory will catch fire and burn to the ground. I have broken no laws. We will start again next year.
And the money? Is ransom not a crime?
What ransom? He is making a donation to the schools of Hebron in appreciation for my caring for his daughter in his time of grief. If the IDF was interested in rescuing the child, they would have sent their soldiers long before this. No, Fakir. This is Summers alone, not the IDF.
I agree. And think of what wondrous things we can do with all that money,
Fayez said.
Arif, will you contact Sami and Aziz and tell them that the deliveries are to take place tomorrow? We are a go.
Dmitri paused his video when Evgeny walked into the room.
I drove by his house earlier this evening, Evgeny said. I thought I might catch Kelsen at his home, but his stupid chauffeur saw me and waved at me. Did you stop?
Evgeny shook his head.
No. I saw him rush into the house, so I have to figure he tells Kelsen that he saw me.
Dmitri nodded and took a sip of vodka.
I wait around the corner until I see the lights of a Lexus pull down the block. Sure enough, it's Kelsen, driving himself. I follow him into the Lincoln Park neighborhood. He parks behind the taxi cab. There are people on the street. I can do nothing. When the cab leaves, Kelsen walks up to a door where a woman is standing. A couple of words and the two of them go inside. Who was the woman?
No idea.
That old weasel. He's getting action on the side.
That's what I think, too.
So I figure it better be good because it's the last action he's ever gonna get. I turn on the light and wait for him to come out.
Good work.
No, Dmitri, not good. Half hour later, a car pulls up. Two men get out, knock on the door, and arrest Kelsen.
Dmitri looked at his cocktail glass and flung it at the wall.
I told you to get him right away. Now the government has him. We can get to him like we got to Summers. You're a fool. No one will get near him. I'm sure he spilled his guts. It's probably too late already. We need to get out of here. Call Ilya. Tell him to file his flight plan to Moscow immediately. He must be ready to leave first thing tomorrow morning.
Dmitri walked upstairs and into the bedroom, where his wife was reading a magazine.
Inessa, we need to leave. Tell Lavi to pack his things. We're going to Moscow for a while. He has school. He can't just leave. He'll fail his classes. Besides, I have Pilates class tomorrow. I don't want to go. This is too sudden.
Dmitri clasped his hands around her face.
I am not making suggestions. I'm telling you to pack. We leave tomorrow morning. You do what you want. I'm staying here.
Dmitri leaned over until his lips were inches from her face.
Stay if you wish. I can find tits anywhere on earth. But I am taking my son. If you interfere in any way, I will slice you like a potato.
He let her go and left the room. Chapter 73. A blue truck, its sides emblazoned with Mediterranean Medical Supply in English and Hebrew letters in bright yellow, pulled out of the company's distribution center. Instead of taking the direct route to the hospitals, Sami drove across town to a cold storage facility in West Jerusalem. The weather was clear and traffic was light. He pulled his truck into Global Fisheries, and the overhead door was closed. Inside, Aziz and his men quickly switched the boxes of Sexton IV sets with Al-Zahani's poisonous substitutes stored in the cold storage room. The job completed, the blue delivery truck was once again on its way. Three hospitals and two clinics were scheduled to receive their deliveries, a total of 2,600 IV sets, 2,000 of which were secretly manufactured in the laboratories of Dr. Arif Al-Zahani. Sami was dressed in his standard uniform, a dark blue jumpsuit with a yellow canvas belt. The oval symbol of Mediterranean Medical Supply, grape leaves around the rod of Asclepius, was sewn onto the left shirt pocket. As with all MMS uniforms, the employee's name was neatly embroidered in Hebrew script above the pocket. A plastic identification card hung on a cord around his neck. Sami backed his delivery truck into the loading dock of Jerusalem Memorial Hospital and hopped out of the driver's seat with his clipboard. A handful of papers were bound to the board by a rubber band. He knocked on the reception door.
Delivery, Jake,
Sami said to the guard at the door.
22 boxes of IV sets.
The security guard looked at his daily manifest.
Right in here, Shmuel.
He opened the delivery door and Sami wheeled the hand truck into the hospital's pharmacy department. The pharmacy staff greeted the familiar delivery man and promptly unloaded the shipment.
ER needs 300 sets immediately,
said one hospital worker.
I'll take them right upstairs,
an orderly replied. Sami tipped his hat and was on his way. At the next stop, Samir handed the clipboard to the guard at the loading dock, who carefully studied the bill of lading. He shook his head.
The IV sets are correct, Sammy, but your order is short. We're also expecting PICC lines and infusion pumps.
Two of our trucks are down today. We concentrated on filling the orders for IV sets. The rest of the order will come later today or tomorrow.
No matter, just bring the boxes in.
Sammy nodded and wheeled the boxes into the hospital. The hospital staff placed Al-Zahani's IV sets in the central pharmaceutical department, available for immediate use. Samir nodded to the staff and drove to the next hospital on his route. The routine was repeated at each stop without incident. Every hospital accepted and placed the deliveries into current inventory. His mission completed, Samir returned the trucks to Mediterranean, retrieved his car, and drove to his home. Al-Zahani's cell phone buzzed. He read the text and smiled. Immediately he called Faiz.
The resting places have been achieved, he said, and hung up.
Yevgeny carried the luggage from Dmitri's front hall to the limo in the driveway. Dmitri and David hurried out the door and slid into the back seat. The sun had yet to rise, and the April morning had laid a covering of frost on the lawn. Yevgeny was about to shut the door when Inessa came running out of the house, her robe barely tied around her nightgown. She climbed into the back, fastened her seatbelt, and said in an animated tone,
So, we're off to the mother country.
The car quickly left the quiet suburb and headed south along I-294. There was little traffic in the pre-dawn hours and nothing was said on the way.
David fell asleep and leaned his head against his mother. 70 minutes later, they pulled into Independence Executive Airport and into a private hangar.
The motors of the Gulfstream were whining when they arrived. They quickly climbed the metal stairs and took their seats in the plane. Dmitri nervously looked out the window. The airport was quiet. No other planes were on the runways. The cabin door closed and the plane moved slowly forward from the hangar and made its way to the apron where it stopped. After it remained stationary for a few minutes, Dmitri took off his belt and hurried to the cockpit.
Why aren't we taking off? Why did you stop?
Sorry, sir, but we have not received clearance to take off, the pilot said.
Call the tower, find out what's holding us up.
I have done that, sir. They've asked us to wait. Perhaps there is an incoming flight or an emergency. The plane sat for another 10 minutes. Dmitri squirmed in his seat. Finally, he once again unbuckled his belt and scampered to the cockpit.
We need to go. Call them again, he ordered.
Independence Ground, Gulfstream November Romeo 5-4 Echo on West Apron, request clearance for departure, direction east.
Negative, Gulfstream, request is denied. Please hold your position at this time. There's a total ground stop.
The pilot looked at Dmitri and shrugged.
Go anyway. Just go.
I can't, I'll lose my license. Dmitri pulled a gun from his pocket.
Go.
Independence Ground, Gulfstream November Romeo 5-4 Echo, proceeding runway 3 right, departing east.
Do not take off. Repeat, do not proceed. You are to stay at the apron, Gulfstream. There's a ground stop.
Dmitri sat in the jump seat, his gun pointed at the pilot.
Go.
The plane started moving forward, but stopped abruptly.
What are you doing? Shouted Dmitri. I said to go.
The pilot pointed out the window. 4 police cars were directly in the plane's path and headed toward them, their lights flashing.
Shit, said Dmitri.
Chapter 74. Kayla and Liam held the conference room doors open as Marcy guided Jack's wheelchair to the table. Finding it difficult to sit erect, he leaned to the side, wincing in obvious discomfort. His complexion was pasty, and beads of sweat had formed on his forehead. The strain of the journey had taken its toll. The group joined Harry and the others, who rose to greet them. An aerial photo of Al-Zahani's compound was projected on a retractable screen. The photo clearly depicted the property surrounded by the perimeter wall, his outbuilding, his home, a garage, and 3 individuals walking through the yard were identifiable. 4 guards were pictured standing outside the perimeter walls. A parking area with 6 old cars was located to the rear of the outbuilding.
Welcome to Tel Aviv, Eliezer said.
Make yourselves comfortable. I hope your flight was not too strenuous. It's good to be back, sir. Thank you, Kayla said as she took her seat.
I thank you as well, Jack said. I'm looking forward to seeing my daughter and taking her home.
His voice was shaky and his bearing unsteady. Eliezer gestured to the table and introduced the notables in attendance, the Israeli defense minister, the public security minister, the Shin Bet chief, and the IDF chief of staff. When all were settled, he said,
We have less than 3 days to learn the details of the terrorist plot and stop the operation. As we understand it, the proposed exchange is set for noon tomorrow in the Al-Zahani compound. Am I right, Kayla?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
It's only fair to tell you we've been discussing the urgency of the situation all morning. There's considerable support for preemptive raid as early as tonight.
You can't do that, Jack said. Sophie'd get caught in the crossfire.
Indeed,
Eliezer answered calmly.
I'm afraid that's an unfortunate possibility. Our young soldiers may also get caught in the crossfire, and it's not something we take lightly. But we are carrying a heavy responsibility here. We must protect our citizens from terrorism.
But a preemptive raid is only under discussion, right? Kayla said. You haven't made up your mind?
Out of deference to you,
Eliezer said.
Harry tells us that you fear the group will destroy the building and the evidence of the plot.
They've said so. It's on the recording. They're prepared to firebomb the building.
What is the current situation at the property?
The entire compound is full of security guards, Yonit said. We've watched it day and night.
There are always guards outside the walls, never fewer than 3, sometimes as many as 5. We believe we've spotted armed guards within the compound, some near the doors of the outbuilding where the devices are being assembled. That factory, or laboratory, whatever it is working 24/7. 3 shifts of workers leave and enter the property at specified times of day. The front gate opens at 7 a.m., 3 p.m., and 11 p.m. punctually. Workers come and go. Other than that shift change, the gate is locked, and we presume fortified.
That supports my opinion that the compound cannot be breached without considerable resistance, Kayla said. Such an engagement would take time and allow Al-Zahani to destroy the building.
It wouldn't take that much time, said the IDF chief of staff confidently.
How much time would it take for Al-Zahani to trigger the bomb, not only destroying the laboratory, but anyone near it, including our soldiers? Can you give me assurances, Moshi?
Eliezer said. Moshi shook his head.
Of course not.
Eliezer turned to Kayla.
This man, he would destroy all of his employees as well as put his own home at risk?
I know from personal experience that Al-Zahani is ruthless and cares nothing for human life that gets in the way of his agenda, Kayla said. Collateral damage will not deter his mission.
But he will open the gates for you and Mr. Summers and let you walk into his house.
Correct. And we will distract the doctor long enough for you to gain access to the outbuilding. Eliezer turned to his IDF chief.
And you can respond quickly with your soldiers?
He nodded.
Certainly, but seconds are critical. Once in the home, Kayla may need to take affirmative measures to stop Al-Zahani from triggering the explosives.
Understood, Kayla said. But I'm not so sure he'll be anxious to set off the bomb. He's an arrogant man. He probably thinks he's got a foolproof plan for taking the money and disposing of us. He'll be transfixed on the briefcase. Undoubtedly, he has no intention of turning over the child, and he won't be eager to destroy his building. He wants to continue with his operations later this summer.
Al-Zahani is aware there are 3 of you?
Eliezer said.
Liam set up the conditions for the exchange through Abu Hamad. Al-Zahani was informed that Jack was confined to a wheelchair and would be accompanied by a nurse, so he knows there will be 3.
What about this young lady?
Eliezer pointed to Marcy.
She stays here. No, let me go with Jack. I can go as his wife. I can push the wheelchair. You'll need someone to help with Sophie. She'll be frightened. She knows me.
Out of the question, Kayla said. We told him there would be 3.
You'll just get in the way. We made a deal, remember?
Do not let her go, Jack said, his breathing labored.
She stays here. Jack, I'm sorry, Marcy, but Kayla's right. You wait for me.
If anything happens to me, you must take Sophie to Deborah.
Really, Marcy, it's better that you stay here in Tel Aviv, Kayla said. The IDF will make sure Sophie gets to you.
What do you mean, the IDF? Jack said. What about you?
He looked hard at Kayla, who shrugged.
You don't think you're going to make it back, do you?
Well, I certainly intend to. But I'm aware of the risks involved. I've got a job to do.
You mean you've got a score to settle, Liam said.
We need to move on here, Eliezer interjected. I see no reason why Marcy cannot go to Kiryat Arba, where you'll stay tonight. It's apparent to me that she's a comforting presence for Jack.
Eliezer smiled.
He needs care, and she can care for him until the mission begins. And she can assist in bringing the child home.
I disagree, sir, Kayla said.
She should stay here. She's a civilian. The mission will be dangerous, even in Kiryat Arba.
Excuse me, Liam said, raising his hand. Civilian, right here.
Quite right, Eliezer said. I see three civilians at this table. All willing volunteers on this mission.
Speaking of my own personal agenda, Liam said with a quick nod to Kayla, I booked a return flight to Chicago, and I intend to be on it. Turning to Eliezer, he said, I'd like to know what support we'll have, sir, and how you've scripted this op.
You'll have full IDF support, of course.
Eliezer gestured to the uniformed woman at the end of the table.
Colonel Yonit Gershon will be on the ground and running this operation. Yonit, if you please.
Yonit stood and walked to the screen. Her uniform, olive slacks and a short-sleeved shirt, was fitted snugly to her taut frame. Her dark hair was pulled back and tied. She reminded Liam of a panther. Quick, powerful, perceptive, dangerous.
We will have troops here, here, and here, just outside the view of the security cameras.
Yonit pointed to the aerial photo.
We'll have transports around the corner, here and here. The four guards outside the wall will be taken down simultaneously the moment you've entered the home. Quickly thereafter, we'll secure the entire compound. They'll expect you to arrive in the vehicle. And since Jack is in a wheelchair, we have prepared and modified a handicap van, the type that is routinely available for rental agencies. In fact, it's waiting for you downstairs. You'll drive it to Kiryat Arba.
She changed the picture to a gray Chrysler van.
This is your vehicle. There's a wheelchair lift, as shown here.
She advanced the slide to depict the van with the side door open.
We're making some assumptions here. We expect the guards to search the van, and each of you, before the gates are opened. When they're confident you have no weapons, they'll open the gate and allow you to proceed into the compound and up to the house.
No weapons, Liam said. We're going in with no weapons? Even Al-Zahani wouldn't think we're that dumb. I have a gun.
We know, but you can't bring a gun. This has been arranged as a peaceful exchange. There's no way they're going to let you in with a gun. We've planted weapons in the van, and I'll get to that in a few minutes,
Yonit continued.
The IDF will have substantial assets on the ground to back you up, but you'll be on your own once you're inside the home.
Do you think Al-Zahani will have guards inside? Kayla said.
Maybe.
Extra guards? I don't think so, Liam answered. He'll have that big guy we saw with Sophie. But Al-Zahani's going to think he's safe within his house. We'll go inside to make the exchange. I figure he takes the money, then maneuvers us outside where he plans to have his guards shoot us. He's not going to want to have a gunfight in his house, especially with the child present. What's the collective judgment here?
We can't discount another guard or two inside, but we agree. He probably won't want a gunfight in his house,
Moshe answered. And once we walk out the door, the light brigade will be waiting in the yard to protect us, right? Liam said.
That's the plan.
Too many things can go wrong with that plan. I want a gun. I want Kayla to have a gun.
I told you we have planted weapons in the van,
Yonit said. Liam shook his head. They're going to search the van. I'm a PI. They'll expect me to have a gun. Who would go to a gunfight without a gun?
He's right, Yonit, Eliezer said. He should go with his gun. They would expect that. They'll take it from him outside, and then maybe they won't look so carefully in the van. Even better.
You guys are nuts. I'm not going in without a gun.
Yonit shook her head and spoke forcefully. They won't let you in the house with your gun.
But if you pay attention, we'll tell you where you can find a hidden gun. If I pay attention...
Your Irish charm is fading, Kayla said.
Charm. He has charm, Yonit said.
When you get to the house and once they finish searching you outside the gates and they take your gun, we expect you will get back into the van and drive through the gates. That is the plan. There will be weapons in the van which they will not have found. You can extract them and hide them in the pockets of your jacket.
Why won't they find the weapons?
Because they are in the hidden chamber in the back of the center console that will not open for them.
What if they search the vehicle and then instruct us to walk through the gates? Liam said. What if they insist on driving the van into the compound themselves? What if one of their guards gets into the van with us? What if they search us again after we get in the gates? In all those scenarios, how do we get weapons?
We don't think they'll search it twice. There would be no reason to do that.
Why would they let us drive into the yard by ourselves?
Why not? There are only 3 seats in the van. Driver, passenger, wheelchair. 3 chairs, 3 tushes. No room for anybody else. They won't want you to leave the van in the street. They'll direct you into the compound.
Yonit, you're logical. Your plan is logical, Liam said. But the terrorists may not be logical. What if one of them gets into the driver's seat? Now what?
Still okay, Eliezer said. We've considered the possibility that the guards will take possession of the van and drive it into the yard and tell you and Kayla to walk. But Jack is locked into the wheelchair seat, and somebody has to operate the power lift. This, they cannot do.
Why not? They don't have disabled people in Hebron?
Did someone once accuse this man of having Irish charm?
Eliezer said.
We've made the chairlift impossible to operate unless you know the sequence of the buttons,
Yonit said.
There's a code. There are 2 controls in the van.
The one in front of Jack's wheelchair is not functional. It will not work.
He will ask for assistance. The guards will try to operate the master controls on the door panel, but they won't be able to move the chair without knowing the code. They'll still need you or Kayla to enter the code and operate the lift to get Jack out of the van. There's a chamber hidden into the back of the center console. Once the code is activated, the clasp on the back of the console will release and the weapons can be accessed.
And they won't see us.
The position of your body should block their vision. Each of you will wear a jacket. There will be 2 small handguns hidden in the console.
Yonit spread her hands and shrugged.
We have confidence that you can do it.
So let me get this straight, Liam said. We get into the yard and Kayla and I get out of the van. The guards search the van, but the console's not open, so they don't see the guns. We hear Jack say that his controls are not working. He needs someone to push the buttons on the door. The guards go over to operate the controls on the door, but they don't know the code, so the chair doesn't move. So I offer to operate the lift. I put in the code, the chairlift is lowering, the back of the console opens, I take the guns, slip them in my jacket pockets, and no one can see me do it. Right?
Exactly.
Are you kidding me? That's the plan?
Eliezer shrugged. Why not? It's perfect.
Has anyone practiced this maneuver?
Not yet.
Oh, Jesus.
The van is downstairs. We can all go practice. I have high confidence in the plan.
Oh, Jesus, Liam repeated.
Obviously, if you have hesitation, you need not participate. Your involvement, while highly valuable, is not compulsory as is ours,
Eliezer said.
We are prepared for the alternative, which is launching the raid tonight.
No, please don't, Jack said.
Someone has to protect Sophie.
I need to get inside. We need to get inside, Kayla said,
with as little commotion as possible. We know that Al-Zahani's laboratory continues to assemble IEDs, explosives, chemicals, whatever, at the rate of 40 bags per day. The recorded conversation disclosed Al-Zahani's intent to repeat the attack at some future date, so he's stockpiling.
If you storm the compound, he blows the building, we learn nothing of the plan, and we have no grounds to arrest Al-Zahani. Then he's free to organize the next attack. Eliezer and Yonit nodded. Although we know his mind the building, he's not going to be eager to throw the switch, Kayla continued. He's arrogant and ambitious, a fatal combination. If he doesn't have time or the inclination to detonate the building, we can seize the remaining devices, interrogate the workers, and learn what we need to know about the pending operation in Jerusalem. For that, we need to get inside, and Jack is our only ticket. I understand, Liam said. I'm just pointing out the risks when everything doesn't go according to plan. Then what? Improvisation, I'm afraid, Eliezer said. You'll be mic'd and we'll be listening. When or if something goes wrong, you'll alert us and the IDF will move in. You may have to scramble to access the weapons and do your best. Eliezer eyed each of the attendees at the table. Are we all on board with this? Each nodded approval. Eliezer stood. Yonit will show you the van. You'll want to practice. He smiled. As the group filed out, Eliezer stopped Liam. I understand it was your idea to tell Al-Zahani that the briefcase is armed to explode. Very clever. You know he would have certainly shot you all the moment you showed up. Eliezer nodded and slapped Liam on the back. Clever indeed. We did it in Antrim in 1996. Same plot, different movie. So where's the briefcase and the money? Yonit has them. A little under 4 million euros and 500 euro notes. 8.5 kilos. The case is metal, rotary combination, and otherwise, quite ordinary. You get all that into a metal case? 4 million euros? Approximately 30 inches of bills stacked top to bottom. They fit quite nicely. All counterfeit, of course. Counterfeit? That's hardly the IDF stamp of confidence, is it? If he succeeds in opening the briefcase, getting his hands on the money and killing us all, well, at least we've managed to give him bogus money. Eliezer shrugged and gave Liam a weak smile. Outside, a standard handicap van sat in the parking lot, a metal platform extending from the open door and resting on the pavement. We've opted for a mechanized platform rather than just a ramp, for obvious reasons, said Yonit. This is top of the line. The wheelchair locks onto the movable platform. Two sets of controls, one in front of the wheelchair and one just inside the door behind the passenger seat, operate the motor. As you can see, there are three buttons on each control box. The top button, labeled Retract, engages the motor to raise the platform from street level. The middle button is a pause or stop button. The bottom button, labeled Exit, slides the platform from its passenger position sideways to the doorway and then down to the street. The mechanisms are simple to operate, unless you have reprogrammed them, as we have done. The lift will not work at all without the code. Here, look. To engage the lift in either direction, you must first double-press the pause button. That will prevent the guards from operating the lift. They'll push the bottom button, and when the chair fails to move, you'll offer your assistance. Standing in the doorway, blocking their vision, when you double-click the middle button and the platform engages, this panel behind the center console, above the air conditioning vent, will release. There will be two loaded handguns inside. Leaning over to guide the wheelchair will place your hand in proximity of the guns. Your actions should not be visible to others. Liam stepped on the runner. His frame blocked the door. He pressed the middle button twice and then the bottom button. The lift engaged, and the back of the center console opened. He saw the two small handguns inside. Yonit smiled. There, you have the weapons. Liam managed the maneuver without detection from behind, placing the guns in the inner pockets of his jacket as the wheelchair was lowered to the street. Liam nodded. Very smooth. He ran the test again without a flaw. Then it's a go for tomorrow at noon, Eliezer said. You'll reassemble in Kiryat Arba. Godspeed, ladies and gentlemen. Chapter 75. Lubana. When Sophie comes home from Majassa, I'm going to talk to her, and I want you to talk to her with me. Does this concern her father and his visit?
Al-Zahani nodded.
It does. I want no part in this, Lubana. I appeal to your reason. Did I not arrange to take her from Chicago, that depraved and unholy land, and bring her to Hebron, just so that you could be with her?
She nodded.
Have I not always had her best interests in my heart? Do I not raise her as my own daughter?
Yes, you do.
Then stop questioning me. Cooperate with me and help us to take the next step. To sever all ties with her American past. To help her accept her life here.
What is it you want me to do?
Just be supportive. Talk to her with me. And when Summers comes, help me to calm her and comfort her on her loss. That's all.
What loss?
Summers will come. He will offer us money. We will allow him to see Sophie, that she's being raised properly, and he will leave. Sophie will be told the truth, that he has left her for good. She must make a break with her futile, incessant pining.
I will talk to her. I will support you. But she is strong-willed, like her mother.
She will not believe us.
When Summers comes, she will be uncontrollable.
Leave it to me. I will handle it.
Bashir entered the house with Sophie.
The little one had a very good day. Her teacher told me so.
Really? Al-Zahani said.
Tell me, Sophie.
Teacher said my painting was the best in the class.
She held up a watercolor on construction paper.
Very, very good.
Al-Zahani held it up, turned it from side to side, and smiled.
I see many trees. Where is it?
It's a park in Wisconsin where my daddy took me.
Al-Zahani shook his head and put the picture on a table.
Yojoda and I would like to talk to you.
Sit down here.
He patted the couch.
You know, your father has not talked to you in many, many months.
But that's because...
No, wait.
He held his hand up and closed his eyes.
I have demonstrated to you that he left the city. Left your house, and most importantly, left you. He quit his job, and he went away by himself to be apart from everyone he knew. Including you, Sophie.
I don't believe...
Wait, child. No one knew where he went. You made the phone calls. His house was empty. He quit his job. But I knew how sad you have been about this, so I said, I have to find this man for my Sophie. I searched and searched, and I sent men all around the world to find your father. And you know what? I finally did it. I found him.
Sophie jumped off the couch.
You did?
She threw her arms around him and hugged him.
Oh, thank you, Jadi, thank you.
He patted her on the head.
Do not thank me so much yet. Your father did not want to come here. He didn't want to see you. I'm sorry to say.
Tears welled up in Sophie's eyes.
You're a liar. You're a big liar.
Wait, I knew you would say that. So I made him promise to come here anyway. He's bringing some papers. The papers will say that he wants us to raise you here in Hebron. You will see for yourself. He will be carrying a satchel when he comes, and inside that satchel will be the papers.
No, he won't. He will want to take me home, and I will go with him.
Oh, my child. I despair deeply of your impending disappointment. I ask only that you not get your hopes too high for something that will not happen. He has told me he will not take you with him. He has moved on in his life. Please, child, do not take my word for it. See for yourself. He will come here tomorrow, and in his hand he will have a case. When you see that case, you will know that I have told you the truth. Then, if you will leave us alone for a little bit so I can review the papers, I will let you go outside and talk to your father all you want. That is, if he will even stay long enough to talk to you. If I'm lying about what I've said and he wants to take you home, you can go with him. I will not stop you. But if I'm telling the truth, then you have to stop all this crying and pining about going back to Chicago.
Sophie looked at Lubana.
Is this true?
It is true, my Sophie. It is all true.
When is he coming?
Tomorrow at noon.
Chapter 76. Marcy, Kayla, and Jack took their places in the van, pulled away from Mossad headquarters, and followed Yonit's car toward Kiryat Arba. The hills looked peaceful in the moonlight, their tranquility belying the havoc that was sure to await them beyond the next ridge.
Yonit took the southern route past Yavne,
Kiryat Gat, Beit Guvrin National Park, and into the West Bank through a southern checkpoint. She dropped Liam at a four-story building and drove off. Kayla pulled in seconds later and parked the van along the curb.
"Unit will be here in the morning," Liam said. "She'll have the briefcases, our microphones, and Kayla's nurse's uniform. She assured me Al-Zahani would take my gun for me at the front gate, and that the hidden gun trick would work perfectly. Not so comforting, I'm afraid. Oh, and she said to get a good night's sleep."
"Why don't we take a ride by the house in the morning?" Jack said. "Maybe I could catch Sophie on her way to school. We might be able to avoid the confrontation altogether."
"Jack, you're dreaming," Liam said quietly. "Do you think he's going to be careless with Sophie on the day he's expecting $5 million?
Kayla nodded.
"She's never alone anyway. She's guarded to and from school. You know we can never do that."
"Let's be honest," Marcy said. "You wouldn't do it if you could. Sophie's your passport into the compound. If Sophie was walking down the street by herself, you wouldn't stop to pick her up. That's the sorry fact of the whole thing."
"Stop, Marcy," Jack said. "If it wasn't for Kayla, we'd never see Sophie again. This is the only way I can bring her home."
"He'd better get clemency or immunity or something for doing this," Marcy said. "He better not put his life on the line to stop a terrorist attack just to return to prison. You need to take care of him."
"I promise. I'll push as hard as I can," Kayla said.
At midnight, the apartment was dark and quiet. Liam found a bottle of Jameson in the cabinet, poured a couple of inches into a glass, and sat alone on a stool at the kitchen counter, musing over the events that had brought him to this juncture. A call from Walter Jenkins, a meeting in a conference room, and the simple skip trace turns into a firestorm in Hebron. Life's road has funny turns. He reached into his pocket and took out a picture he had ripped from a magazine before he left Honolulu. Solitaire wedding rings. There'd been no time before they left. It all just happened so fast. They would have to wait until he got home.
"Buy me a drink," Kayla said, sliding onto a stool beside him.
He filled another tumbler and placed it before her. They clinked their glasses.
"You know there's no way this goes down easy," Liam said. "Jack's a sitting duck. No pun intended."
"As long as they think it's just a ransom exchange and that you're the muscle he brought from Chicago, we have the element of surprise. They won't be ready for the IDF.
I like Yonit. Her fearless bearing, that inner strength. I can see why men would follow her into battle.
And women."
He nodded and smiled sheepishly.
"And women, of course."
"That's an unusual name, Yonit.
In Hebrew it means dove."
"Dove? Oh, that's terrific, just what we need."
They sat in silence for a few minutes. Liam looked down, swirled the whiskey in his glass.
"How do you see this playing out?"
"I hope it's pretty much as Eliza and Yonit have said. We'll pull up to the gate. The guards will search us."
"I'm not giving up my gun."
Kayla pursed her lips.
"They won't let you go in with it."
"We'll see. I don't trust this hidden gun trick in the van, and I'm sure not walking into a terrorist's house unarmed."
Kayla shrugged.
"Well, you'll have to play it as you see it. You've been in situations before. Just don't lose sight of the mission. We need to get inside the house to Al-Zahani."
Liam took a sip of his drink.
"You mean you need to get to Al-Zahani?"
Kayla looked hard at Liam and emptied her glass. Liam freshened it.
"This mission doesn't depend on ransoming Sophie," Liam said quietly. "A military squadron can neutralize the compound in a New York minute."
"Neutralize? As in destroy?" "Of course. But what of the terrorist operation? What of the IEDs already in place in Jerusalem? The threat is legitimate, and we don't know the particulars. I'm positive the secrets are locked away in the outbuilding, and we can't allow it to be destroyed. If everything goes down as planned, that'll be the best of all worlds. We'll get Al-Zahani and enough information to stop the attack."
"And our evil doctor?" "You don't want him neutralized, do you?"
"That's too easy. This mission's about you and Al-Zahani.
She took another drink.
I want him alive. He needs to be interrogated. He's a fountain of information. But you're right. It's more than that. It's personal.
It has to do with the wedding, doesn't it? Kayla nodded and took a deep breath.
Yes, it does. His gang of terrorists, the Son of Canaan, killed my husband, Brian Cummings. We'd been married barely 3 years. Two teenagers shot him out of the window of a car on the streets of Hebron, at Marot HaMachpelah, the holiest of sites. They fired wildly at the wedding party and sped away. A wedding party, Liam. Just peaceful, happy celebrants, dancing their way to a marriage ceremony at a holy site. Not soldiers, politicians, combatants, not policymakers or oppressors. They threatened no one. They harmed no one. Just a fucking wedding party. They all deserved to live long, happy lives. But they were cut down by brainwashed, misguided youths, driven to murder by hateful puppeteers.
And Al-Zahani?
The most wicked of them all. He was not only vicariously responsible for the death of my husband, he personally murdered my sister.
Liam said nothing. He sat in shocked silence, his hands wrapped around the tumbler. He stared at the counter, unable to meet her gaze. Finally, he lifted his head. Kayla's eyes were red, but her face was steeled.
Until Jack and I talked recently, I hadn't put the pieces together. I didn't know what Al-Zahani had done. I didn't know the depths of his wickedness. I had no idea until I learned the details of Jack's story. Then it all came together.
She pushed her glass over for a refill.
My sister Naomi was to be married that day.
She was the bride? Kayla nodded.
She was standing right beside me. I was the maid of honor. I held her as she fell.
Oh, my lord, I'm so sorry. Kayla emptied her glass.
As she approached the ceremony on the happiest day of her life, she took a bullet, critically, in the lower abdomen. She needed medical care immediately.
They shouted for a doctor and were directed to Al-Zahani's home by a security guard.
Joshua, her husband-to-be, carried her unconscious body into Al-Zahani's house. Reluctant at first, Al-Zahani agreed to treat her. He stopped the bleeding and bound the wounds. He saved her life.
Liam looked at her quizzically.
He wouldn't accept any money or even a thank you. He directed Joshua to take her to an Israeli hospital, which we did.
Kayla reached over and grabbed Liam's forearms. He felt her fingernails dig into his flesh.
Naomi lay at Jerusalem Memorial for 3 days, recovering nicely. We talked about my husband. She comforted me. We talked about the others. The ones who were laid to rest while she was in the hospital. I urged her to reset the wedding as soon as possible. For herself, for my husband, and for all those who wanted to rejoice with her.
Kayla paused. Her lips quivered. She moistened them with her tongue.
And then the infection set in. At first she thought she had the flu, but then it got worse. The doctors attribute it to the Good Samaritan care she received after the shooting, closing the wound and being stitched in a non-sterile environment. A likely consequence, they said. They would treat it with antibiotics, they said. But they couldn't control the infection. It was a wildly aggressive bacterium. It had spread internally, attacking her organs. It ate her up from the inside out. She died 6 days later. Until I met Jack, I never realized what had really happened. He told me about his wife, Alina, who'd come to Hebron when her mother had a heart attack and returned to Chicago with an infection. Just the same. The doctors could not control it, and she died. The way Jack described Alina, all the symptoms, he could have been talking about Naomi. And then I remembered the boy in the hospital. The one I told you about.
The shooter.
Right.
IDF caught one of the shooters, a 17-year-old boy who had been wounded in the leg, but not a serious wound. I made several visits to the hospital to question him. Most of the time he was delirious in a drugged-out state. I caught him a few times in half-lucid moments, and he identified Nizar Muhammad, Fakir Ali, Faiz Talib, and the Sons of Canaan. But not Al-Zahani. Here's the thing. Al-Zahani was his doctor.
No doubt the reason he was drugged out and couldn't talk to you. Kayla nodded.
After 3 days, the boy came down with an infection. The same as Naomi. The same as Alina. Horrible. Internal bleeding. He lasted 9 days.
He killed them all, Liam said.
He killed them all. He poisoned them with virulent bacteria. He killed the boy to silence him. He killed my sister because she was an Israeli Jew who came to him for treatment. And he killed his own daughter, his very own daughter, because she had the temerity to fall in love outside his ordained parameters.
I'm so sorry for you. I almost wish you'd never found out about the connection.
So painful a death. The brutal way in which they suffered. That's his plan for the attack, you know. It has to be. He's not a munitions expert. He's a laboratory scientist.
How could he possibly infect 2,000 people with a superbug?
I don't know. That's why we have to get into that building. But I know one thing. The bugs are already in Jerusalem.
Let me ask you something. Be honest with me. Do you know for a fact that Al-Zahani has rigged the building to explode?
Kayla shrugged. For a fact? No.
I knew it.
You said for a fact. I heard him say so on the recording. Do you want to take that chance? Personally, I think Al-Zahani would go to great lengths not to destroy his laboratory. As I said before, he's arrogant and ambitious. He's like Dr. Frankenstein in there, growing genetically modified germs, superbugs for use as weapons in his jihad. I doubt very much he plans to blow up the building. But a quick takeover before anyone can pull the trigger would remove any possibility that I'm wrong. And the best way to quickly secure the building is for us to get inside.
The IDF could secure it quickly enough. You know that's true.
They'd also stand a damn good chance of taking out Al-Zahani and rescuing Sophie. I don't have that level of confidence. I don't want to rely on a damn good chance. Al-Zahani will blow up his lab and all his workers in a minute to save his operation. Human life means nothing to him. We're better off getting inside with the ransom exchange and preventing him from pushing the button. And besides, I want him alive. I want to take him into custody, interrogate him, and bring him to justice. Not just him, but everyone he's connected with, including Nizar Muhammad and Fakir Ali, and the godfather Faiz Talib, and whatever group's been funding them. I want them all, and I don't want any suicides, no martyrs. I don't want any Hebron elementary schools named after Al-Zahani or the Sons of Canaan.
Liam nodded. Assuming he buys this ransom charade, when do you think he'll make his move?
Outside, after the payoff. I agree that he won't want a gunfight in his home in front of his wife and granddaughter. He'll complete the transaction, get his money, and walk us outside where he thinks the security guards will be waiting.
But the IDF will be there instead?
That's the plan. If they're not, I hope you have a gun and you're a damn good shot.
Liam swallowed the last bit of whiskey and set his glass down.
I keep thinking about what Mike Tyson said. Everyone has a plan until you punch them in the face.